So this week has been VBS. We had about 130 kids here every night, and it was so exciting to be part of a whole team of people introducing these kids to Jesus and inviting them to express faith in Jesus. We talked about stories about Jesus all week, where Jesus shows that he's the Son of God, proves that he's the Son of God, and invites us to express that faith in him. But that raises a question, and that is this: what does it mean to have faith in Jesus? What does that look like? And so Hebrews 11 is a chapter that helps us answer this question. 2 weeks ago, Alvin kicked off the series on Hebrews 11 by giving us the dictionary definition of faith: complete trust or confidence in someone or something, or strong belief in the doctrines of a religion based on spiritual conviction rather than on proof. That last line, based on spiritual conviction rather than on proof, begins to feel like when we talk about faith, we're talking about a blind leap. We don't have any proof, we're just believing it. So we want to carefully distinguish what we mean by faith. When we're talking about a leap of faith, is that an appropriate way to describe the Christian faith? Alvin told us that faith is not a blind leap. A blind leap would be like this. Let's say you had a dream last night that you could fly. Anybody had flying dreams before? Flying dreams are the most fun. Like, I would just launch off the stage and fly around this room. It'd be so fun. I don't have them very often anymore. But it would be very reckless of me if I woke up after a flying dream and then climbed to the top of the Maxwell Center and launched out, right? That's not faith, that's recklessness. Because there's no, I don't have those abilities in my natural body, so that would not make sense. But faith that we're talking about in God is not a blind leap, but more like the leap of a child off of the edge of a pool into the water when mom or dad is standing right there in the water. That kind of a leap where you know you're going to be caught, you're maybe afraid of drowning, but you know there's a parent there who's going to make sure that you don't drown. God's proven past makes him worthy of our faith. And so just like a parent has proved over and over that they're trustworthy to a child, God is trustworthy for us. We take calculated risks all the time, like a child leaping off the edge of a pool. How many of you have been to the dentist this year? Okay, this happened last service too. I'm a little concerned. It's like about half of you are getting regular dental care. okay, take care of that later. Dental health is important. No, we went to the dentist recently, and I have never met our dentist here in Three Hills. I don't know her personally. But somehow, I'm willing to get into a chair, lean back, and open wide and let her put sharp things into my mouth. What makes me take that kind of a calculated risk? Well, I notice, there's a sign, Three Hills Dental. I notice there's credentials framed on the walls. I notice they have all the right equipment there. The hygienists are trained. There's professional staff manning the desk. And so all these things, and maybe we ask around, hey, is there a dentist in Three Hills? Yeah, should we go to that dentist? And all those things added together make me willing to take a calculated risk and give her access to my mouth. Because I'm confident in her professional abilities, and I'm pretty sure that the medical system would root out a fraud, and I wouldn't need to be the one to do that. In Hebrews chapter 11, we're told that faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. Notice the emphasis on seeing and not seeing. If we could already see it, we wouldn't need any faith. It would just be here. It would just be a fact. But we don't have faith in just anything. We can't just imagine up any unseen reality and make it to be so by having faith in it, right? So it has to be probable. When I was pregnant with our youngest, Easton, he's 11 now. When I was pregnant with Easton, just before he was born, our oldest was 7. And she sat me down and she said, "Mom, when the baby's born, you're going to have a lot more work to do because you'll have to be nursing him and changing his diaper and taking care of him, and so I just want you to know I'm going to do all the hard work. I said, okay, tell me, what do you mean by that? Well, she was going to do the laundry and the cleaning, and she was going to cook dinner, and she was going to do the dishes. And as thoughtful as that was, and as serious as she was about her commitment to doing all those things, I knew better. I did not have faith in her ability to do all the hard work, because I've been an adult for a while at that point, and I realized that age 7 isn't up to the task. So according to Hebrews, true faith involves taking confident action based on what we can't see, but that confident action is not wishful thinking. It's based on the character and track record of the one who's making the promise. In this case, God. I took my students once on a field trip in Oregon to an Eastern Orthodox church. Anybody ever been inside an Eastern Orthodox church? It is quite the experience. You walk through the door and it's like you've instantly gone back in time 1,000 years. The sanctuary is exactly the same as it was 1,000 years ago. There's pictures covering every inch of the wall with portraits of saints, men and women from the past who've walked with God faithfully. There's candles burning and incense, and the whole place just has this really amazing aura about it. Well, that may seem odd to us, but for Eastern Orthodox worshipers, for believers who attend there, those portraits that are lining the walls are helpful reminders, telling them that they're not alone in their faith journey, that they're not, it's not all up to them to carry the faith forward, that they're part of a team. And so for those of us who are evangelicals who don't have our walls covered with these pictures of saints, Hebrews 11 is trying to accomplish that for us. Hebrews 11 is giving us that cloud of witnesses, men and women who are cheering us on in our race. Here's what we need to know about these people cheering us on. The people in the grandstands are not perfect. So the men and women we're going to meet in Hebrews 11 didn't make the list because they were totally awesome at everything they ever tried to do. They also don't have these kind of amazing qualifications in every area of life. And they're not cookie cutters of each other. They're all very different. Each one lived out their faith in concrete ways in their own circumstances. And the point is this. We should not think of our faith journey as a solo hike in the woods. It's not just me and Jesus. But actually, it's a community event. We're not alone. We're part of a great cloud of witnesses. We're part of a great community of faith. And we can learn from each other and be inspired by each other's examples. So today, we're meeting the first two faces in this crowd, Abel and Enoch. Both men are shrouded in mystery, and we'll need the help of the Old Testament to figure out what it is that made them make it on the list. Now, I said to Alvin when he first asked me to preach on Enoch, I said, there's not a lot about Enoch in the Bible. He said, just talk really slow. but then he gave me Abel too, so I think we'll be okay. So here's what we're going to discover. Faith is not just what you think, it's what you do. And with both of these men, we're going to discover that. Belief translates into action. Faith becomes faithfulness. So first, Abel. We're told, by faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. And by faith, Abel still speaks, even though he's dead. So I've got two burning questions. I highlighted them in red. Number one, what made Abel's offering better? Why is his better than Cain's? And number two, in what sense does Abel still speak? That sounds a little creepy. So for answers to these questions, we turn back to Genesis chapter 4. Now, if you're not familiar with Cain and Abel, these are the two sons of Adam and Eve. So we're going way back to the beginning. And we're told that Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, and Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. So what made Abel's offering better? Well, we find out more almost from what is not said than what is said. We're told Cain gives some of the fruits of the soil. So to help us with this, maybe you could imagine a neighbor of yours who has a garden. And let's say they grow zucchini. And you know that the knock is coming on your door. It'll probably be, you know, a couple weeks yet, and they'll knock on your door and say, "Hey, I've got too much zucchini. Would you like some?" And you know this will happen because it's not possible to actually grow a small amount of zucchini. If you try, we're just gonna get a small amount of zucchini this year. No, zucchini has a way of just multiplying, and it's more than any family can possibly eat. So imagine it's as if Cain is bringing some of his zucchini to God. Like, there's no great merit in this offering. It's not like he's giving up something that cost him. Actually, it's saving him from eating it. When we first moved to Three Hills, what was so amusing to me is that people in this town did not ask, "Where did you buy a house?" They asked, "Whose house did you buy?" It cracked me up. Like, wow, this really must be a small town. So for all of you who have not asked me that question yet, we bought the Kozak's house. And maybe some of you are like, "Oh, I've been there." So maybe you know that the Kozaks planted 4 cherry trees in their backyard. And when we got taken around to see houses, Rod Perks took us to this house, and the cherries were all just, it was these beautiful trees. And I said, can these cherries be eaten? He says, "Oh, no, nobody eats these." But I looked it up, and Evan's cherries are edible. They actually make really great pies. They're good pie cherries, and they make great cobblers. But there's only so much cherry pie you can eat in a year. So in about 6 weeks, if I offer you some cherries, it is not because I'm some kind of wow. It's because we have way more cherries than we can possibly finish. We actually still have cherries in our freezer from 2017 when we moved in. So please help us with our cherries. So Cain is bringing God some of the fruits of his soil, and you get the sense from what is not said that he's not giving God his best or his first fruits, which is what they're supposed to do, is bring their first fruits, give God the first and best, but he's got a basket of zucchini and cherries. Abel, on the other hand, gives fat portions of his firstborn of his flock. So he's giving God, he's living his life in recognition that everything he has belongs to God. So he doesn't need to hoard and keep the best for himself. He brings it willingly. He brings God the best cut of meat, and he puts God first. Both brothers would have claimed to believe in God, but Cain's actions show otherwise. They show a sort of half-heartedness in his faith. And we learn a lot more about Cain from how he responds, because God says he prefers Abel's offering over Cain's, and Cain's response is this. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. And the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted?" Cain's angry response reveals the state of his heart. If he was truly interested in pleasing God, then finding out that his offering didn't please God should have prompted repentance. He should have said, "Oh, what was I thinking? Here, have some of my best produce. Have my first produce." But no, he doesn't want to please God. He just wants to appear to be good. And when God exposes the shortcut that he took, it made him angry. The key sentence is this last sentence in red, verse 7. If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? Cain could have pleased God too. This is not the case where God predetermined before the foundation of the world that he would like Abel and not like Cain. It's not like Cain is up against an impossible task. God's requirements are not arbitrary. His response is not willy-nilly. Instead of owning his hypocrisy, Cain takes out his anger on his brother. And it says, we get the story of the first murder. Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." Cain reminds me of one of my students. At another institution in another location, I had a student named Brandon. We'll call him Brandon. He signed up for my Psalms class, and on the first day of class, he came in the back door of the classroom, and he sat in the chair that was right by the back door, and he pulled his baseball cap down over his eyes, and he slouched in his chair. And it was very obvious to me that he would rather not be in this class. Somebody was making him take it. Well, things did not improve over the course of the first few class periods. We're just going through the syllabus. I'm just telling them about the assignments that we're going to have, and his hand shoots up in the air. All of a sudden, he's interested. And I call on him, and he says, "Yeah, I'm not trying to be disrespectful or anything, but like maybe you could explain to us maybe your thinking behind, like, why are you making us do this assignment? Like, what would be the point?" And I said, "Well, you know, that's a really good question. I would be happy to explain what my thinking is on this assignment." So I tried to respond really gently. I don't know if he got the gentleness that Alvin gets. I tried to explain, and he's like, "Huh." So next class, again, he's raising his hand. He's being very abrasive and confrontational. I was really tempted to ask in the middle of class. I didn't do it, but I was really tempted to ask one day, "If I had a beard, would you ask me that question?" Because I just had this sense, that he was not okay with me being a woman as his teacher, and like he just didn't want to be there. So in addition to being disrespectful to me, and belligerent in other ways, he also was breaking the rules like every class period. So our class policy was no cell phones, no laptops, because I wanted their full attention. And he was on his phone like every day. And he'd get it out, and he'd be, like, right in plain view. I can see him back there in the chair, and he's on his phone. He's not even trying to hide it. And I'm like, okay, I got to do something about this. So one day, I write him an email, because it's not like I can catch him before he leaves. He's out the door. So I write him an email, "Brandon, it seems obvious to me that you don't want to be in my class. And I've done everything that I can to make this class interesting and engaging. And you are showing all the signs of this not being interesting and engaging. So if you have ideas for me on how I could make this class more interesting, I would love to hear them. In the meantime, please keep your cell phone turned off and put away for the duration of the semester. And if I see it out again, I'll have to ask you to leave." That was way more confrontational than I like to be. But I felt like I needed to send the email. So I sent it on a Friday, and it was quiet. Nothing Saturday. Sunday afternoon, I get a response. "When are you in your office? I want to come talk to you." And my heart starts pounding, because this is Mr. Abrasive, and I can just imagine all the things he's about to say. "Okay, your assignments are really dumb. You're treating us like children, and I'm an adult now, and I could be on my cell phone if I want. I'm paying tuition to be here." I mean, I've got all the responses ready, and I'm like, oh boy. So I tell him Tuesday he can meet me at my office. And on Tuesday I go into work, and I tell the faculty secretary, "Okay, there's a student who's coming in to see me. I'm a little nervous about this meeting, and I don't think it's going to go well. So we're going to meet out here in the lobby, and I just want you to know about it so that you can, like, be another set of eyes and ears." And so I let her know, and I wait out in the lobby. And Brandon comes up, and I'm like, "Hey, have a seat." And he goes, "Can we meet in your office?" And I'm like, sure. So we walk past the secretary to my office, and I'm like, like, I want her to see. We're going in my office now, but I don't think she saw us. And we went into my office and sat down. He says, "Can we close the door?" And I'm like, oh no, he wants to yell at me, and he doesn't want anybody else to hear. So I close the door, and I'm nervous, and then I notice he's shaking. And he says, I'm just here to apologize. I've had a really bad attitude, and you did not deserve that. And I just want you to know that it's going to be different from now on. And I'm sorry." And I was like, whoa, okay, different conversation than the one I imagined. I said, "Brandon, thank you for coming to see me. This must have been really hard for you." He goes, "Well, yeah," he's got his head in his hands. "I think God's been trying to get my attention lately." "Really? Tell me more." And he says, "Well, Friday when I got your email, I also got called in by the coach of the baseball team. And he says I'm off the team. He cut me." whoa, that's serious. Like, can I ask why? And he says, I guess he noticed the same bad attitude that you did and he was tired of it. Wow, okay. So he says, yeah, and it actually, the story starts back before this. He says, I was in grade 12 and I was playing on the baseball team in my high school and we were headed to state. He was one of the star players on his high school baseball team, headed to the state championship. It's the last week of school. And in one of his classes, he had a substitute teacher, a female. And she caught him on his phone, and she put him in detention. And as much as he tried to say, look, I'll do anything. I'll clean your classroom. What can I do? She's like, nope, you knew the rule, and you broke it, so you're in detention. And that made him ineligible to play in his championship baseball game. So yes, he was coming into my class with a chip on his shoulder about female teachers who have cell phone policies. And yet, when I confronted him, he did what Cain ought to have done when God confronted him. He repented. He was soft. And he was ready to live in a new way. He felt, I could see it on his face, he felt like this was the end of the world. Like, everything's falling apart. And I looked him in the eye and I said, Brandon, I know this feels like the end of the world to you, but I want you to know that this is the beginning of something amazing. Because you have just owned your sin. You've just repented. And do you know what God can do with somebody who's humble and owns their mistakes? The future is looking really bright for you, and I can't wait to see what God does. And sure enough, from then on, whenever he saw me on campus, he had a big grin on his face. Hey, Carmen, how's it going? We got along really great after that. And he was very engaged in class. So unlike Cain, Brandon owned his problem. So that's the first question. Why is Abel's offering better? The second question, in what sense does Abel still speak? The key sentence is in verse 10. Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So Hebrews doesn't retell us the story of the murder. It assumes we already know that story. But I find it really interesting that his death is mentioned, as if to remind us, having faith or living faithfully does not guarantee a happy ending. The reward God promises may not come in this life. It may not come until the next life. So faith is trusting that God will not forget our just reward. And the rightness of Abel's actions, the generosity of his offering to God, and his innocent death ensures that his testimony of faith lives on. So his blood is figuratively still speaking about his innocence. Cain tried to silence Abel out of jealousy. But death does not bring an end to faith. That's what Cain didn't understand. Because faith is not rooted in what we can see, but rather in what is yet to come. By offering his first and best to God, Abel demonstrated that he believed in a God he could not see, and that he believed that God rewards those who earnestly seek him. So Abel is the first portrait of faith that we're meeting this morning, and Enoch is the second. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. So again, I have two burning questions. One, does the Old Testament really say that Enoch didn't die? Because that seems a little sketchy. And how did Enoch please God? What did he do? So everything we know about Enoch from the Old Testament comes from a genealogy, which pretty much guarantees that most of us in this room haven't spent much time reading it. So if we look in Genesis chapter 5, we're dropped in the middle of this genealogy, and it says this: when Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. After he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked faithfully with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived a total of 365 years. Enoch walked faithfully with God, and then he was no more because God took him away. Now, on its own, this phrase, then he was no more, could be a euphemistic way of referring to death. We use lots of these euphemisms when people die. He fell asleep, he passed on to glory, he was promoted, he's gone on home. So we could imagine, well, maybe that's what this is talking about. God took him away. However, if we look at the rest of the genealogy, we see that there's a pattern, and this is a break in the pattern. So first we meet Adam. Adam lived a total of 930 years, and then he died. Seth lived a total of 912 years, and then he died. Enosh died. Kenan died. Mahalalel died. So everybody, like, clearly died. When we get to Enoch, the pattern is broken. There was something different about him. We don't know how God took him. We just know that his life didn't end normally. But why? How did Enoch please God? We're told he walked faithfully with him for 300 years. Now, I don't think we need to get hung up on exactly what Enoch did that meant he walked faithfully. Like, it doesn't tell us, but we don't have to use our imaginations too much because the rest of the Bible tells us how to walk faithfully with God, right? What things you do and what things you don't do that constitute faithfulness. So I don't think we need to get hung up on it, but if you are curious, we do have some clues in the New Testament as to how the audience of the book of Hebrews would have thought about Enoch and his faith. So the tiny book of Jude, just before Revelation, refers back to something called the Book of Enoch. It's not in our Bibles, and it's not inspired scripture. You might think of it as like the Left Behind series of the first century. So it's like popular Jewish religious literature written in the intertestamental period, and Enoch is larger than life. His book is actually quite bizarre. People find it very interesting, but it's not... You know, think of it in the category of Narnia or Lord of the Rings or Left Behind. It's not scripture. But still, Jude is willing to refer back to it by way of illustration because it's what everybody's reading. And they all know the stories. So these legends about Enoch include a little piece that Jude refers to. So Jude is in the middle of warning the church about ungodly people who are driven by what they see and feel instead of living in light of God's truth. He actually uses Cain as an example of someone who follows natural instincts instead of living by the Spirit. And then he writes in verses 14 and 15, Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about them. See, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones to judge everyone and to convict all of them of all the ungodly acts they have committed in their ungodliness and of all the defiant words ungodly sinners have spoken against him. So for first century listeners, they know Enoch. Enoch is a popular hero who is not worried about what other people think of him. He's willing to speak out hard truths to his generation. He's warning them about the coming judgment of God, something they can't yet see. And he stands alone in his day against ungodliness. We don't please God by following the crowd. This is not the way to sort of get ahead in the kingdom of God, is by doing what everyone else is doing. So a story comes to mind. When I was in junior high, I remember right where I was standing in the library when a classmate came up to me. So Carmen, are you going to the dance tonight? Actually, it was more like, so Carmen, are you going to the dance tonight? And I said, nope. And she just had this look of exasperation cross over her. Carmen, how can you ever expect to be popular if you don't go to stuff? And I said, Julie, I'm not trying to be popular. And she was like, what? Isn't that the whole thing? Isn't that the whole goal? And you could tell she was living her life just to be liked by her peers. And she found me really exasperating because I didn't seem to care whether other kids thought I was cool. This story about Enoch has implications for all of us. If our lives are characterized by doing what everyone else is doing, we won't be different. But back to Enoch, here's my favorite part. Enoch was not always this way. If we read it carefully, we see that he didn't always stand out. Look at what it says. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. After he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked faithfully with God 300 years. It seems to indicate that something happened with the birth of Methuselah. Something happened at 65 years old that changed the trajectory of Enoch's life. As long as you're alive, it is never too late to shift the trajectory of your life. Maybe there's someone here in this room who's 65 years old. Or maybe you're not 65, but you're thinking, man, I don't want to wait that long to change. You've made a lot of mistakes. You've lived for yourself. You've pursued success. Maybe you've stepped on others to get to where you are in life. Maybe you're harboring hidden unforgiveness, hidden anger, hidden addictions that are controlling you. Today could be the beginning of something new. Hebrews gives us the recipe for change. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. So step one is to believe that he exists, not just a mental assent or even a public declaration, yeah, there's a God, but with a life that proves it. Yes, there is a God, and the way I live matters because at the end there will be a reckoning. I will give him my best even though I can't see him because I believe he's really there. Step two is to believe in that day of reckoning. Believe that he rewards those who seek him. And we demonstrate that by walking faithfully with him, because faith is not just what we think, it's what we do. So yes, it's true, faith transforms our thinking. Faith involves that transformation, but it also makes a difference in how we live, because what we believe becomes what we do. Faith is not just a mental decision, it has practical consequences. Enoch believed that God's judgment was real, even though he couldn't see it. And he learned to live for what he could not see, because what is most real cannot be seen. Abel believed that God was worthy of his best offering. Like Abel and like Enoch, we must learn to live for what we cannot see, because what is most real cannot be seen. If I believe my dad is trustworthy, I jump to him in the pool, even though I don't want to drown, because I trust that he's going to save me. 21 years ago, Danny and I got married. We were about 10 and 12 years old at the time. We vowed to be faithful to each other until death do us part, but our love for each other is not just measured by our mental decision or even a feeling that we have for each other. Our love is measured in action. Do we make time for each other? Do we include each other in our big decisions? Do we serve each other? So Danny proves his love for me every day when I come home to a hot meal. Like, that's a practical way of demonstrating his love. And I prove my love for him by coming home on time to that hot meal to be with him and our kids. If you know me at all, you know I love my job. And I could work 24/7. I love it so much. But I say, no, I'm committed to my family, and I come home and I show up. That's a way of showing that we matter to each other. So do you believe in God? If your faith is real, it will translate into action. And some of those actions might seem really odd to your neighbors. You might do strange things like give up a leisurely weekend morning every single week to listen to a sermon like this one. You might voluntarily give up the first 10% of your income so that Pastor Alvin can have a paycheck. You might give up your evenings for a whole week to hang out with energetic children to tell them about Jesus, even though you've already put in a full day's work, or you have a nursing exam the next day, which was the case for several of our volunteers. You may refuse to make a business deal that would profit you greatly because you know it's unethical. You may continue to treat a coworker kindly, even when they're rude to you all the time. Faith is not just what you think, it's what you do. It translates into faithful action. Abel and Enoch are examples for us. They're not perfect, and they're not the same. Abel died an untimely death. Enoch never died. but both men stood out among their peers as people who honored God. They lived differently in their generation, and they're cheering us on. So let's follow their example. I'm going to close with this blessing from the end of the book of Hebrews. Now may the God of peace, who through the blood of the eternal covenant brought back from the dead our Lord Jesus, that great shepherd of the sheep, equip you with everything good for doing his will, and may he work in us what is pleasing to him through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen.